tonight on The Download. Former Chicago alderman and civil rights leader Dorothy Tillman. From the Netflix show Love, Paul Rust. And from the Afghan Whigs, musician Greg Dooley. Now, here's your host, a man who can't believe it's already April, Justin Kaufman.
Not exactly how we wanted to start the home journey for the Chicago White Sox when extra innings lost to the Detroit Tigers, but some strong things for a young rebuilding team. Got to be up by more than four. Getting into the eighth inning. Hello, everybody. Justin Kaufman here with The Download, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Getting a late start thanks to a game in which we thought we had in the bag. I had already started writing the carryout, writing, oh, what a game. The Sox clobber the Tigers. And obviously that did not happen. The Chicago White Sox bullpen implodes in the eighth and ninth inning and extra innings in the tenth. So, but that's okay. It's you got to wipe yourself. You got to wipe the snow from your face. As they say in baseball, get up the next day, wipe the snow from your face. It's ridiculous. I feel for the people who went out to the game. You know, this is—I mean, what a day here at WGN Radio. We did the broadcast at Cork and Carey. I was on with Cochran in the morning. This is a long day of White Sox celebration, and to think about the people who are out there who wanted to actually be a part of this home opener and put on the gloves, with hand warmers out there, everything in that came with. Celebrating the White Sox coming back to Chicago 2018. Yeah, I'm not sure they were too excited about an extra inning. Especially when it starts to look dark at the guaranteed rate. So, but you know what? Loss, like I said, they got the day off tomorrow. Come back on Saturday. We got a great show lined up tonight, you guys. So excited. We're a little bit behind, but that's okay. Not unlike if you get delayed flying out of O'Hare and you want to fly to L.A., San Francisco, something like that. And the pilot says, you know, we'll make up time in the air. That's what we're going to do tonight. We'll make our time up tonight. Matt Moog's going to join us. Matt Moog, a longtime entrepreneur, CEO, business leader, tech leader here in the city of Chicago. He's going to be my guest at the Download in Chicago Business right after the 8 o'clock news. Talk to him about customer reviews. That's the business he's in right now. And it's really amazing to me, for foresight, first of all. I mean, he's been involved in online customer review platforms and making it easier for both companies and users to review consumer products for years now. And to think about when you go to shop, whether it be online at Amazon or anywhere, and that had become part of the culture now. You don't ever buy a product without saying, let me see what the reviews are. It's amazing how that has become part of the way we shop. And a lot of that has to do with the work that Matt Moog has done for years here in Chicago. So we'll talk with him at the Download Chicago Business coming up at 8 o'clock. Also tonight, Alderman Dorothy Tillman, former alderman, 3rd Ward. Of course, we know Dorothy Tillman. She was a long, outspoken spokesperson for the Chicago South Side, black community here in Chicago. She's as well a civil rights leader who studied under Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was a part of LeBron James' documentary that just aired, Rise Up. Dorothy Tillman was featured in that. We'll talk with her. She'll be my guest at the big table. Excited to have Dorothy Tillman in studio. I've never had a chance to sit down and talk with her. I'm very excited to talk with her, not just about what the lessons learned in the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, but just her career here in Chicago. Born in Alabama, here in Chicago, has made a name for herself as an outspoken voice for equality. And she was always known for the hats that she would wear at city council. Hopefully she'll wear a hat tonight. I hope so. But I'm very excited and honored to talk with Dorothy Tillman coming up. The big table tonight. Also, new show on WTTW, Dish-alicious. It's a cooking show, a twist on the format from the creators of Check Please, David Manilow. Sarah Gruenberg, the chef at Monteverde, who's been on this program. She's won James Beers. She's the host. She is making the transition. She's still the chef at Monteverde, but she's making the transition to television. And she, of course, of Top Chef fame, is now going to host a show that's going to start tomorrow night on WTTW. She is here live tonight. Talk about this show, why she's doing this, and also her career. And I mean, the hits never stop here. Greg Dooley from the Afghan Whigs will join us. They're coming to the Riv with Built to Spill. So we'll talk with Greg Dooley. What an amazing career that guy's had. And then Paul Rust joins us again. Paul Rust is the co-creator with Judd Apatow of the show Love on Netflix. And he joined us when that show debuted, and the final season just came out, and we're very honored that he would come back and talk about what he learned from the three seasons of Love on Netflix. So that's tonight on The Download. Huge show. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martyr, Esmeralda Leon. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download. Pete Zimmerman's here as well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get the news, Rob Martyr, and then we'll start the show. So stay with us.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I don't know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
Hey, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for The Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment where we feature CEOs and entrepreneurs telling their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, Matt Moog. Moog has been a fixture in Chicago's startup community, both as a founder and CEO of companies like CoolSavings.com and Built in Chicago, but also as an angel investor who was behind creating the fund Firestarter. Moog's latest is called Power Reviews, a company that he acquired and merged with his company Viewpoints back in 2014. It's a consumer products review platform, giving consumers the ability to become advocates, but also giving businesses the tools they need to manage and display those reviews. And if you've bought anything online, you know the power of the customer review. It's now essential before anyone buys anything. Moog has had quite a career in the business, acquiring, merging, surviving the dot-com bust. He even helped create MSN for Microsoft back in the mid-90s. He started his own companies. He's been part of corporate America, and he's been a leader in the tech industry here in Chicago for over 20-plus years. And he is my guest tonight in Download in Chicago Business. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Justin.
All right, so let's get to Power Reviews. Let's start with this guy. I mean, it's amazing to think about how when you started your company Viewpoints, consumer reviews were still on the fringe, where it was something where you wanted to get that in front of people because that could help with the bottom line. But now, I mean, it is essential. I mean, with Amazon and other places, people don't buy anything without customer reviews.
Yeah, that's really what happened. I mean, Amazon made them popular initially, and more companies have adopted them, and that's led to more consumers expecting them to be there. And now it's at the point where over 90% of consumers won't make a purchase unless there's reviews there.
Does that surprise you?
Well, it certainly surprises me how ubiquitous it's become. And when we talk to customers, retailers, brands around the world, there's never an argument about whether or not they need reviews. It's just the key is getting coverage, getting enough reviews that there's a critical mass and it's credible.
And I would also assume that at one point or another, it became crowdsourcing at best and worst. We've seen that a little bit with Yelp and other places where customer reviews were great, but they also were bad. You had situations where you couldn't control if you were a business, if somebody gave you a nasty review for whatever reason, personal perhaps.
Sure.
You couldn't control it. But with your company and others, it's really also about managing those reviews so companies can get the right reviews to the right consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we focus an awful lot on authenticity and fraud and things like that to make sure that the reviews are authentic. So the vast majority of reviews we collect are from verified purchasers of the product. So it is different for local reviews of local businesses. It's harder to verify that they were an actual customer. For product reviews, it's much easier to know that they actually own the product and they're not associated with it, et cetera.
Are you surprised that the business that you're in, that you started with Viewpoints almost a decade now, that has blown up in the way that now people think of marketing and they think of even any business practice online, they have to have customer reviews? And I would assume there aren't a lot of competition, or maybe there are more than ever now than when you started.
Yeah, well, when you've been in this business for long enough, you start to see reviews absolutely everywhere. You go into the bathroom and it asks you to rate the bathroom. You go onto the subway, it says rate the subway. Travel, books, movies, dining. You realize it's in every facet of society, and we're looking forward to the day when it gets there with healthcare, with education, with government services, so that it's truly everywhere. And the part that we appreciate about it, I guess, is that reviews really bring transparency and accountability to businesses. They help the consumer make a better decision, but they really help the business make better products.
What's the challenge? I mean, I think about the fact that everybody wants to rate everything. Do people wade in too quick if you're a business, saying, let's put 5 stars on this and see what happens? I mean, does the technology have to catch up? I mean, what are some of the things that are challenges in this business?
Well, I mean, first, I'll start with one thing. What you just said is most people think that the best possible thing would be a 5-star review. all of our research, which we've done with Northwestern University's Spiegel Center, indicates that a five-star review is actually a bad thing because consumers don't trust it.
They don't believe it, right.
Right, so the optimal rating is about a 4.4, 4.5.
A somewhat recommended.
Yeah. They want to see at least that there's some negative reviews, and if there's no negative reviews, they don't believe the rest of them, basically. So we encourage any kind of product owner, business owner, don't be afraid of negative reviews.
A lot of what your business is really circling around is trends and habits. And for you to be in this business, do you think about how you have swayed consumers in a way that at one point I never thought about it? I was taught that in my consumer ed class, you know, in high school. Make sure you read the reviews, you know, make sure you comparison shop. But right. At this point now, it is, I mean, it's ubiquitous. I mean, there's no other way to shop.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting is every year for the last 20 years when surveys are done, what's really evident is that people trust other people more than they trust corporations or advertising or marketing messages. And that so it's a good trend towards we're making available very authentic opinions of other people so that when you go to buy a product that it's going to be high quality, it's going to be sustainable. It's not going to be that toaster that always frustrates you because it's breaking down or the clothes that don't look good after wearing them once or twice. Mm-hmm. So we see ourselves playing a pretty essential role of helping people spend their money more wisely and buy products that are sustainable.
Do the customers that you have and the businesses that you work with, do they understand that? Or are there still some that are holding out saying, I don't need reviews. I've got commercials on the TV.
Like, right.
Well, I mean, are people understanding that it is part and parcel to doing business in 2018?
Yeah. So Power Reviews, we have over 1,000 major businesses around the world who use our platform. And we track about 500 million consumers a month that are consuming those reviews. So we're reaching a half a billion people, right? So, yes, there are some businesses that still resist reviews. Many of those are, frankly, because their business model depends on selling low-cost, low-quality products, and they don't really want to tell the world that how low-quality they are.
That would fall into the challenge category.
Yeah, yes. There's also one category is luxury goods that, in many cases, you know, they sort of see themselves as above reviews, but even that those kind of companies are starting to come around. Mm-hmm. But certainly all the major retailers that most of us shop at, most of the major brands that we buy, have adopted reviews wholeheartedly. And many of them see it as like the world's greatest focus group. Like this is more product-specific feedback than they've ever received in the history of their company.
Matt Moog's in studio. He's the man behind Power Reviews, which we're talking about the online customer review and how it's changed consumer habits. But let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about the tech community here in Chicago and your career, which is a roller coaster. I mean, it's up and down, and you have such success, and you're one of the leaders in this community. But even your story, which is a success story, there are ups and there are downs when it comes to doing business, not just here in Chicago, but on this planet. Matt sure. Moog is my guest tonight at Download in Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Matt Moog is in studio talking about online customer reviews tonight, but also his career. Power Reviews is his company now, but I can go down a list of all of the companies you've been involved with here in Chicago and all around the country, but obviously Viewpoints, CoolSavings.com, Built in Chicago, which is and where we can start the conversation, just really the setup for the tech community as we know it today. A lot of people will look to 1871 and other places and incubators bring people together, but Built in Chicago really was a website early, and it was essentially a forum to bring the tech community together.
Yeah.
How has that evolved? Because at the time, there was it was a much smaller space. Now, I mean, we had Howard in here, Betsy Ziegler in here not too long ago talking about, 13% of Chicago's economy. It has evolved in a way that a lot of people are coming here. So how have you seen the tech community evolve in your time here in Chicago?
Yeah, it's a good question. We started Built in Chicago about 8 years ago, and it was basically a bunch of entrepreneurs at my office with pizza and beer talking about what can we do to help the Chicago tech community grow. And what became really clear is that we just needed a place, a sort of a watering hole for the tech community. So when we needed to hire people or raise money or just become known, that there was a way to do that. So we launched Built in Chicago as just an experiment. And shortly into it, we had 5-10,000 users. And Maria Katras, who's the co-founder and CEO, came along, saw it, and saw the potential of it, and took it over. And she said, let me be CEO and grow this thing. And she's done an incredible job. And we now has millions of users. Yeah. And is in 6 cities around the country and expanding. And it has over 1,000 jobs listed right now on the site, and features all the different tech startups. So it's,
you know, for Chicago, it is interesting because this it really is a symbol for Chicago's tech community. But as I mentioned, it's grown and grown. Does it have to change? Does Built in Chicago have to change in the way that there are many more players, mm-hmm. and there's much more competition? Does it make it harder to have an online community when the community is bustling?
No, I think in some ways it makes it easier because there's just frankly more to talk about and there's more companies. When we first got it started, Marie and I sat down and basically made a list of every tech company in Chicago we could think of and added up how many employees they had. And we came to about 20,000 total employees. And today that number is well over 50,000 people employed by those companies. And it's been growing very, very steadily. And the number of companies every year that get funded, that get started. I led the project to launch 1871. We started Firestarter Fund. But there's now 10, 15 different early stage venture capital funds. So all of those things contribute to that. And honestly, the universities in this area, whether it's Northwestern, U of C, IIT, DePaul, right. Loyola, they're all really on board with computer science programs, design programs, a focus on entrepreneurism. And that's really what fuels a lot of tech ecosystems, is a university that is
right.
producing graduates who want to start those kind of businesses.
It's amazing to me because you could track your career back to Microsoft in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. and how you have been a part of what is now known as the tech community and you know, capital tech, you know, capital T. But to think about how you envision what could happen in Chicago to what is happening, did they line up? Do you think that at the time, going back to the late 90s, did you say, I see a day when the merchandise mart will be all tech and that this will be a 15% of our economy?
Right.
How do you see how this
It's impossible, I think, to predict the specifics. But I think my premise all along has been there's actually more going on here in technology than certainly the rest of the country realizes, but even sometimes people in Chicago. We're marked by the fact that we have a very diversified economy. There's financial service companies and manufacturing and professional services, and unlike San Francisco and others, where it's sort of dominated by technology.
More balanced here.
So, I would say I always knew we had a lot and we would grow. And there is a flywheel effect that the more entrepreneurs there are, the more people want to come here and work for those companies, the more money, and it really has a virtuous cycle effect to it.
Let me ask you, when Betsy and Howard were in here talking about the future of 1871, a lot of it had to do with being able to bring tech to the corporations, the more mainstream corporations that Chicago has, whether it be, you know, the big buildings or McDonald's or anything
sure.
like that.
Sure.
Do you see that as the next frontier for tech community? Not necessarily to just be the startups who disrupt and do their own thing, but to be brought in to modernize the major American companies that everybody knows.
The involvement of the Chicago corporate community is a critical part of the total ecosystem. You need early stage startups. You need fast growing technology companies that employ thousands of people, and you need these big corporations that will buy the companies or employ lots of the workers and have a global footprint and everything else. It goes right along with universities and private equity, and it all has to come together, and they really reinforce each other. The fact that Walgreens and McDonald's and United and Discover and others have moved their e-commerce operations down into the loop is a testament to the talent magnet, basically, that Chicago has been for those kinds of employees.
For you and your career, and I kind of mentioned this right before the break about the roller coaster that has been, but you've worked on several startups, several different initiatives, but also had come from corporate America in the way that you work for Microsoft and other places. There have been success stories and little micro success stories, but there's also been you know, not success stories.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, talk about the roller coaster lifestyle and I guess psychological approach to being an entrepreneur, because it can be the highs of the highs, but it also can be the lows of the lows.
Yeah, I don't know an entrepreneur alive who hasn't experienced some kind of major disruption in their business. And the hallmark is their perseverance and their grit to get through that and find a way to keep the business going, because there's also unexpected opportunities that come along sometimes out of nowhere that you can be in a position to take advantage of.
Do you have to learn that? I mean, as an entrepreneur, is it do you have to evolve and learn that early on? You're like, oh, my life is over. But then by the sixth time it happens to you, you're like, I've been through this. I know how to weather this.
Yeah, it certainly helps. It certainly helps to know that you've been seriously challenged and you've been through a situation where maybe you had to let some employees go or you lost a lot of business or all kinds of things. I mean, I've been through two major situations where, one, the dot-com bubble burst and we lost 50% of our business basically within a month or two, and our revenues seriously declined. And been through another situation where we were building a website that had millions of users and literally overnight lost half of the users from that. But, you know, these things happen.
How, I mean, when you think about your career and the future of being in this business, obviously with Power Reviews, but whatever's next, I mean, you fit into the category of serial entrepreneur. What's your psychological approach? I mean, is it all half full, glasses half full with you and businesses, or do you have to have a certain perspective when you get into this work?
Well, I think you've got to have a certain personality, and sometimes you don't know if you have it until you're in the middle of it and how you'll react to it. I would say my general personality is like only the paranoid survive. So I'm never quite happy with any situation, whether it's going great, you wonder what's going to go wrong, or if it's bad, you're just trying to get yourself out of it. People are different. I know some entrepreneurs that are incredibly calm all the time, and I admire that quite a bit. And others that burn themselves out and they're too frenetic. So it's a combination.
Yeah. Matt Moog, serial entrepreneur, investor, and also the man behind Power Reviews, which is the online customer review company out of Chicago, which is not just Chicago, it's San Francisco, it's all around the world. Matt, can't thank you enough for being my guest tonight on the Download Chicago Business. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Sarah Gruenberg's going to join us. She is the new host of Dish-alicious, which is the new cooking show on Channel 11, which starts tomorrow. Sarah Gruenberg, award-winning, James Beard award-winning chef at Monteverde in the West Loop. And she was, of course, a big success celebrity from Top Chef. And she's now back on television on Channel 11. So we'll talk with Chef Sarah coming up. And also a little bit later, Paul Rust from Love on Netflix, the romantic comedy produced by Judd Apatow. Paul Rust will join us, and also Greg Dooley from The Afghan Whig. So we got a big show lined up coming up here tonight on The Download. My guest tonight at the big table is a longtime Chicagoan who many will know from her work in city council. Former Alderman Dorothy Tillman represented the 3rd Ward, Chicago South Side, from 1985 to 2007. Tillman, known to many for her fashion sense and her trademark hats, but politically, Tillman served as a vocal spokesperson for Chicago's South Side and found herself at odds with various mayors over the year. Well, okay, one mayor.
Various.
One single mayor, Mayor Daley. But many may not know that Dorothy Tillman was part of the civil rights movement right here in Chicago. She was an aide to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. back in 1965, 1966, when King famously came to Chicago as part of the Chicago Freedom Movement to shed light and improve upon the housing conditions for African-Americans on the South and West Sides. Tillman studied under King and was just featured in the LeBron James-produced documentary Rise Up, The Movement That Changed America. Dorothy Tillman is a true Chicago voice, and it is my pleasure to have her as a guest tonight at the big table. Ms. Tillman, thanks for being here. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me. And I'm also a talk show host, you know.
Yeah, I know. Your competition.
No. You know, you're not on Saturday morning. Saturday morning from 6 to 8. But, yeah.
A lot of people know you, and you have been a prominent politician here in Chicago for years. But the civil rights part, and that's what we want to talk about. Okay. You weren't born here in Chicago. You were born in Alabama.
I was actually born in Montgomery, Alabama. I grew up in the civil rights movement. My family was very involved in the Montgomery bus boycott. My pastor, Roland Fields, from Bell Street Baptist Church, he taught us at a young age how to stand up, how to fight. And at 9 years old, my grandmother carried me to the Holt Street Baptist Church, and that's where I first met Dr. King.
Wow.
And I knew, listening to him that night, I knew what I would be doing for the rest of my life, that I would probably be fighting for my people. And when Dr. King talked about Mrs. Parks refusing to give her a seat, a lot of folks said that Mrs. Parks sat in the front of the bus. She did not sit in the front of the bus. She refused to give her a seat up to a white man because when you're in Montgomery, you get on the bus. If you're black, you put your money in, you go back, you sit in your back. And they had a back section for colored people. So, but if the bus got crowded, they said no man's land. So a nigga wouldn't dare stay seated when a white man is standing. And Miss Parks had decided that day she wasn't going to get up.
And no, it was no man's land. So
no man's
someone
land,
came back
that
and
you
said,
get
up. And
you said, no. I don't care.
Right.
You don't sit. So she refused to give her seat. So when Mrs. Parks refused to give her seat, I understood. I understood why she refused to give her seat up, because when I was a little, when I would go and we would put our money in the bus and we had to get off, I never wanted to get off. I would always rebel. And I would ask my grandmother, why? Why? I always said, why? And she could never answer me. But I said, when I get big, I'm going to do something about this. So I would think that that's why my grandmother, Madea, carried me to the Hope Street Baptist Church to hear Dr. King so that he could tell me why I couldn't sit there and what we was going to do
your
about it.
Your history, I mean, and Chicagoans, like I said, they know your history as being a politician and a representative of the African-American community here in Chicago. But, I mean, it is national. When you talk about the civil rights movement,
we'll talk about
you know, you coming to Chicago with Dr. King. But I mean, in Selma, you were one of the first to be in the Selma march, to be on the bridge.
Well, I was among the first 10 to go into Selma on behalf of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to organize and to fight for the right to vote. I was, you know, I tell people all the time that one of the things they didn't know about the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the difference between our movement and other movements were that we had structure. The movements today just out yelling and hollering. But we had structure, and we had field secretaries. Under those field secretaries, you had a staff. I was with part of the direct action. I worked under James Bevel. Direct action meant that if Dr. King said, I'm going to come down Michigan Avenue, and we're going to march and tear it up, then I'll be part of that team that go in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Jose Williams. He was like part of the cleanup.
So everybody knew their role.
Yeah, a group of us was up under. So it was structured.
Yeah.
And we had to read a lot. We had to study. We had to understand the science of nonviolence.
How did you get involved in it? Because you 9 years old, you met Dr. King. You saw him speak at the church. But how did you get involved with the movement?
I was part of the MIA, the Montgomery Improvement Association. That was before the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. My parents was involved in the MIA. Everybody was really involved in the MIA because the MIA was before Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That's the group that was organized around when Mrs. Parks refused to give her seat, that Dr. King became, the ministers got him to be head of that group. So the Montgomery Improvement Association was to improve the plight of the Negro people in Montgomery. So even growing up, we were taught that you stand up wherever we went. It was talking about liberation for black people, for the Negro people. So wherever we went, my pastor taught that. Our parents taught that. We were able to see. I saw Klansmen and stuff riding through the neighborhoods and things we had to confront. But we were always told we were somebody and we could stand up. So it was kind of natural to transform and go work with Dr. King. But my mother and father, when they separated, we moved to Pensacola, which is 2 hours from Montgomery. So I was back and forth in Montgomery and Pensacola. So people would tell you, if they're listening, she's from Pensacola, she's from Montgomery. But so one day, this man came to Montgomery. And he had a whole group with him. James Orange, he had Meatball, he had just a whole group. And after the Birmingham movement, now, most people don't give Jim Bevel credit, but it was Bevel who said, and he was one of the founders of SNCC, and he and his wife, Diane Nash Bevel, they left SNCC and went to Birmingham to join Dr. King's movement to keep it going. And that's how he became part of SCLC. And he said that this movement can't stop. And Belville told Dr. King and all of them, we have to put the children in the street. A lot of the people did not want to do that. And I noticed when I look at the documentary, they just said the children went in the street and folks disagreed. But it was Jim Belville who said, we have to put the children in the street. So after the Birmingham movement, Jim Belville said that we got this legislation, but if we don't get the right to select those who represent us, it won't mean nothing. We have got to get the Negroes the right to vote. Of course, Diane went to the SCLC board, Diane Nash, Diane Belville. She goes by a maiden name now, Diane Nash. But she went to SCLC and she presented the proposal that she and Belville had written. And Dr. King said yes, but everybody got together and they decided they, you know, we need to cool it. So that's when Belville came to Montgomery. Said, I'm just going to go into Montgomery and I'm going to mobilize.
Well, let's do this. I'll take a quick break so we stay on time. But I want to come back, and it's a perfect way for us to make the transition to your first time in the city of Chicago. It was with Dr. King, 1965, mm-hmm. coming here to tour the northern cities as what would become the freedom movement, the Chicago Freedom Movement, 1966. Dorothy Tillman, my guest, former alderman and civil rights leader,
thank you.
In studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll continue the conversation. Stay with
thank
us.
Thank you.
My guest at the big table tonight, former Alderman Dorothy Tillman, civil rights leader, and of course, a longtime advocate for Chicago, and represented the Third Ward in Chicago for years. We're talking about her civil rights career, of course, in the 50th anniversary of not only the assassination of Dr. King, but also the aftermath, the Chicago riots, 1968.
Right, right.
We'll get to that conversation as well. Before we move on to Chicago, just wrapping up
Selma. So then when Belville came, he came and he said, did you know your mother can't pee in the wee? What you mean? He said, if you all don't come and fight the right, if you don't come and fight for the right for them to have the right to vote, then it doesn't mean anything. Well, most of us had grew up in that movement, and we said, I was one of the leaders. They always came to get the leaders of the movement. So I was a leader in my school at Booker T. Washington. He got Leon, who was a leader at Carver, and we were able to pull them together. But in all the demonstration that was going on in Montgomery, so when Jim Clark said that no more than two coloreds can be on the street after dark, and it was Diane Nash who said we should present Wallace with a Declaration of Freedom. And we didn't know what city we were going in at that point. We knew we were going in some city in Alabama. SNCC was already in Selma. So when Wallace did that, that's when we went to Selma. So I was dispatched to Selma as one of the first 10 staff people. But on Bloody Sunday, when blood flowed like a river, we didn't expect them to beat us that day. I was in the center part of the bridge because my job was to, you know, we got training to kind of keep the crowd together. I tell John Lewis all the time, he got in the front because he and Jose, because usually let you go past. That's the first group. And we thought we was going to load up the jails, and Bevel and everybody was back at the church, and we was going to fill the jails up and keep sending them. But blood flowed like a river that day. And I tell you, I'd never seen. We thought Miss Boynton was dead. Miss Boynton, they put her in a hearse, and that's why we thought she was dead. But she wasn't dead. It was taken her to the hospital. So, you know, it's a whole lot to that.
Gosh,
but I know you want to go into
Chicago.
I knew Viola Lewis, so Jimmy Reed, Reverend Reed, the white Unitarian minister who was killed. And Selma, he wasn't really killed there. He was beaten, and he walked into the office. And when he walked into the office, Diane said, well, what's wrong with you? You got to go to the hospital. And she wrote a check to try to get an ambulance to get him to Birmingham so that he could be saved. I met his daughter, and she said they still got copies of the check that Diane had written for their father. So it was a lot, you know.
Oh, man, for you, with the anniversaries, of course, with Selma, but and then of course yesterday and today.
Yes.
Do they bring back traumatic memories? I mean, it's obviously
it brings back a lot.
Does it?
Yeah, you think about it, and you think about the state that we're in today, and I watch the things that people are doing, and especially black people who are being really led and directed by somebody else. Or those people who really want to make a change, they're really being led, but they're really not following. I'm a nonviolent scientist, and they're not following the nonviolent doctrine, you know? A nonviolent, and the third principle of nonviolent, you got principle and you got steps. And the third principle says that you fight the injustice, not the person. Because you can remove the person and injustice is there. And the last step of nonviolence is reconciliation. But you can't have reconciliation if you fight the person rather than the principle. So what I see people doing is they say they're imitating and emulating what Dr. King and our movement was, but they're not.
But they're not following
because they're
the
not
rules.
Following nonviolent yeah. principle. I can't hate you. I got to hate what you do. And I got to deal with that. So nonviolence say you deal with injustice and not the person.
I have so many questions about that. For you as a young woman to come to Chicago in 1965, to come with King to Chicago because the mission took you north yeah. to the northern cities, what comes to mind when you think of Chicago in 1965?
Well, when I first came to Chicago, I was shocked. We toured the north, and we would go from place to place, and we would mobilize and go on. We went to Cleveland, Philadelphia, New York, Detroit, all these places. You know, I was thinking when I was coming out of Michigan and I had to go back around. But anyway, I was thinking about how when we got to Cleveland, we had been here and mobilized, and we got to Cleveland, and it was a message for us at the airport that Dr. King wanted his field staff, his direct action field staff, back in Chicago because he was not comfortable with the people here and in Chicago. And we was staying at, we stayed down at the Conrad Hilton. That's when I think about that when I pass sometimes. So when So after we made the decision to come here, I had never in my life seen black people, blacks, even in the South, if they didn't agree with us, they would go to another place and sit down. But we had black ministers and black elected officials telling us to leave, that they didn't want us here.
The black leaders, black politicians. But
black politicians yeah. and black ministers.
Right, here in
they
Chicago.
They had a major, and that really upset me. I talked to my mother about that. And I remember a meeting, when we had a staff meeting, and I was saying to Dr. King, we don't need to stay here. I want to go to Cleveland. They don't want us here. Why are we staying here? And he said that if we crack Chicago, we'll crack the world. So, but Chicago racism. And I found a lot of the liberal whites in Chicago was more racist than the whites in Alabama.
Really?
And in fact, I have had much more respect for the whites in Alabama.
Well, that's
in Chicago.
I mean, that's famous line that King said here in Chicago, saying it's worse in Chicago than
yeah,
it is in Mississippi.
It's another
right?
kind of yeah. you can't and see. At least we had an interlocking relationship in the South. Blacks and whites, you know, for some way we almost interdependent on each other, you know. And even when the Civil Rights Bill was passed and the public accommodation, if you notice that the South desegregated faster than the North, you go down South, you don't find many segregated schools because what they did is they closed these, did those. So because the Southern whites believe in the law. If the law was, and we had to tell them we are human beings, and you're going to respect us and treat us well, equal, we're going to have equality, and we're going to desegregate. But once the law was made, they abided by the law. Now, but you'll find that in the North, the Northern whites, like in Chicago alone, they skate and get around. That's why you can be in Chicago and have schools with a lot of rats and roaches. You have schools in poor communities where children can't even, they're not learning technology. They're not, there's really just taxpayers' dollars being paid for babysitters. And they're not preparing them to compete. You have a city where you have schools where you're not even preparing children or young men and women to learn vocational training.
A lot of what the Chicago Freedom Movement was about housing. The
right.
housing stock here and,
yes.
and it's famous to
in the slums.
In the slums. You came here in 65 to do the recon mission, to go from Cleveland, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago,
right.
brought back to Chicago. 1966, the Freedom Movement. And in most parts, you stayed in Chicago.
I mean, yeah, I got here on October 31st, 1965. I was transferred to Chicago to work on an open house. We didn't know what we was going to work on at first. We was coming to crack this city. And we was convinced that we, by Reverend Evans and a few of the women on the west side, that housing should be the key thing that we would fight for. And in fact, that's the first time I met Jesse Jackson, because that's when he became a part of our staff when we came to Chicago. And I met him with Reverend Evans. So as we moved around, even though I came from Montgomery with shotgun, two rooms and a kitchen house, I'd never seen no mess like I saw on the west side of Chicago. Those cold flats and Cunning Costellas and the lead peeling on the wall. And blacks could not even go west of Racine. You're talking about going to Oak Park. They couldn't go nowhere. They was trapped in a ghetto, a dark ghetto with very little resources. And now blacks are still trapped with very little resources.
Yeah, we'll talk
and
about that.
And that's the irony of it all.
And of course, as we get to 19, that's where we'll take a break here and get to the news. But when we come back, we'll talk about 1968, because the assassination of King played out as a horror show for the entire country. And then the aftermath, the weeks after, especially in the big city, everywhere in the entire mm-hmm. country, but here in Chicago, a lot of what happened here is still, you know, being remembered 50 years later.
Right.
We'll talk about whether or not it ever recovered. West side of Chicago. Dorothy Tillman is my guest, a longtime civil rights leader and former alderman of the Third Ward here in Chicago. She's my guest at the big table. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, get the news with Robin. We'll continue our conversation. Dorothy Tillman, stay with us. Welcome back to the Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio at the big table, former alderman Dorothy Tillman, civil rights leader. Came to Chicago in 1965 with Dr. Martin Luther King
Jr. October 31st.
And, of course, we're talking to her about the anniversary of the assassination and the subsequent days after, weeks after, here in the city of Chicago. You were here in 1968. Do you remember where you were when you got the news that King was assassinated?
I was at home. I was at home. I was pregnant with my oldest child. And I heard King just got shot. And I called to Memphis. I called some of people who was traveling with them trying to find out what had happened. And then I heard he had gone. And I always like to, I'm so glad you used the word assassination, because a lot of people said he was killed. Assassination is very powerful. That means someone is frightened of you. They're worried about your power. And they assassinate you. And they shot him in his head. And that was to scare the rest of the black leadership, black ministers away. So they said, I'm not getting my brains blowed out. So they shot him. He got shot in the head. And I was pregnant on a leave of absence from SCLC. And I was just messed up. And I was talking to my husband. I just didn't know. And that next day, I went to on Jackson. I had to. And first of all of the staff members who was not down there, who had probably either used to be staff members, had gone on their ways, are still around, they came to my house. And we all met, because I was like central being in Chicago. Yeah. And those some of them came, got to do something. And we got to do something about this. And when they got ready, we said, how can we stop this burning? And we understood the feeling, how people was feeling. So we went on Jackson on the west side. The American Friends Service office was over there.
Okay.
So we went to work out of the American Friends Service office. I remember the troopers put a bayonet in my stomach, and I was pregnant. My son was jumping around. The bayonet, they said, back up, we say.
This is the National Guard, right?
The National Guard, yeah. They said, back up. And I was trying to, he says, I don't want to hear you. You back up. And we really had gotten together, organized, to go stop, try to see what we could do. And in fact, some of the white staff members, we put some natural wigs on them so they could look like mulatto blacks, so they could make it to the west side. We had a big old natural wigs on them and stuff.
For being from, you know, at this point, being in Chicago for a couple of years and knowing the situation that were presented when you came here in 65 with a different kind of racism that you knew in the South, knowing what was happening here from the news reports and the mayor getting in front of the television, was it dangerous? Were you frightened? Were you scared? What
you
was,
mean in 68 or
in 68 after the assassination, what you were doing on the west
at
side?
At this point, we kind of had sized up daily. So I wasn't frightened. You know, it's something about when you've come out of this nonviolent movement and you've worked with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference And you have to remember that we talk about, I hate for folks to call him M.L. King, Martin. He's Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a very spiritual person, and we should always keep him in a spiritual realm. He believed in God. And when you come from the SCLC movement, understanding God, somehow you don't fear death and you don't fear things like that. You know, because we were taught that my soul belongs. You can take the body, but not my soul. And that when you go to fight, you go with your cemetery suit on. So I wasn't fearful of daily. I was worried about my brothers and sisters and they not knowing how to get past the pain it was feeling.
Well, I mean, as someone who had
right
studied with Dr. King and also subscribed to the nonviolent principles you were just mentioning, was it difficult to watch your community, the communities in both the South and West Side? And
you know, the South Side didn't burn.
No.
South Side folks never do nothing. I mean, you know, no, they didn't burn. They didn't do anything. It was the West Side. And the West Side folks always had heart. When we came here with Dr. King, and one day I will take you over to the church where our office was on Warren and Albany. In fact, I take people there. They did a whole story on the last year, Chicago Magazine. I took them over there. The Blue Room and all, even the church still looked like it was. That's where our office was on Warren and Albany.
Yeah.
It was a First Congregational Church. Now it's a Baptist church. And the West Side people, they met us with open arms. We was able. That's why we ended up with our office at the First Congregational Church over there. We could not. We had very few black ministers in Chicago who supported us. We had a handful: Reverend Jackson, Reverend Story Freeman over there on 71st Street, Reverend Evans, Lampkin, a group of ministers. We had about a couple of dozen from that really supported us very strongly. Especially on the South Side, and then we had Reverend Hall, Stone Temple on the West Side. But it was the West Side people who embraced us. It was West Side people who was willing to march and to move with us. They moved with us much faster than the South Side folks. And I don't care if they're listening. They were kind of like, they've always been kind of, they was at that point very safe people. They never acknowledged the fact that they might have had money, but they could not get out of the valley, out of the ghetto. You know, that they had to be confined in a certain area. And what happened is, once we opened the doors, and I tell people all the time that we didn't fight for integration. We fought to desegregate. We fought for equality. We fought for the right to enjoy the American dream. Dr. King was not trying to destroy America. Dr. King was trying to make America live up to all it should be. And that's what I believe. I don't like to be bothered with people trying to do the destruction rather than trying to deal with the injustice.
Well, let me ask you, Ms. Tillman, because a lot this week, of course, from Chicago media and the great pieces in all of the different media outlets that have really dug into what happened 50 years ago.
Right.
They'll talk about what has happened in the West Side of Chicago and talk about its evolution, the idea of what happened in 1968, and you could still see remnants
of it
in 2018. So how do you look at it?
Well, it hurts me. I've carried my daughter and my grandchildren, and I spent a lot of time on the West Side because you still got a lot of people who was involved in the movement that's on the West Side. But I'll show them different parts and what happened, who the people were. It hurts me. I'll come down Warren Avenue, and I showed them where Freedom House was, but now it's gentrified. I show up in Washington where we had a Freedom House and it's gentrified out of where those different families who helped us. The West Side Organization under Chester Robinson on Roosevelt Road, you have a big old UIC got all of that. The West Side Organization with Chester Robinson and Thurston and all of them, those were the brothers who were strong with Dr. King, who protected Dr. King. We had the Deacon of Defense. We had everything over there. So I looked at all of that. You think about Mark Clockenfer and Hampton was on the West Side. When you think about all those places, they got knocked down. So it said you have to have your landmarks. And what have happened historically for black people is that our landmarks have always been knocked down. That's why I was opposed to the statues coming down. People didn't understand. I said, well, no, I would like for it to stay there. I don't think outside people should tell us, those of us who endured slavery, who endured Jim Crow, that you tell us that we should fight to knock the statues down. We should take our children and give them an education about this. But if they all vanish, where's the education?
I want you to come back and continue the conversation because we have so much we haven't talked about. I mean, obviously with the anniversary, there's a lot of people who want to talk. Everyone's, I'm sure your schedule is.
You know, it's all one.
And I want to have.
We can't separate it.
And I want to have a conversation about nonviolent principles and all the other things. As you look at this week and you think and you reflect on your time with Dr. King, but also the fact that you were in Chicago in 1968, and then you turned into a political figure here in Chicago, an alderman for a long time for Third Ward. Where is Chicago when it comes to the things that Dr. King ran?
Well, let me just say that when I was alderman, if you look, you will see I did a 70-30 plan, and I began to bring resources to the community to try to rebuild that community, to try to rebuild businesses, and to make sure we build, to bring people back. We began to bring people back, and that was... I was not like a politician. I was a leader to try to bring those things that Dr. King and Harold Washington believed in back. So what you don't have people who really, not in my community, every community is working on behalf of their community, but you don't have people that's trying to bring back. There's no reason why the West Side should not be rebuilt. And those people had to be uprooted and to be moved, and the taxes go up so high, they have to. It hurts my heart because of how I feel about my people. And to love you, see, somehow people think to love your people mean to hate somebody else. No, I can't love your child if I don't love my child. Don't come tell me that you love my child more than your child. So I love my child and I love yours. But so I'm in pain a lot. I go through a lot of pain now as I look around and I see where we are as a people in this whole country. And I see in Chicago where we are. If I read stories like was in the paper about the rats, and when I read stories about how nasty the schools are, how bad the education are, I read the Tribune, and I read this whole story on what's going on the West Side. When I know that was planned, that's not an accident. It's not because black people do not want businesses or we don't want our communities built. There are no resources being put in those communities. But the sad part about it is those. When we first came here, you didn't have that many blacks in city council. But we got the right to vote. We got open housing. We did all of those things. But those people, and I'm talking about my people, black people, who reaped the educational, the political, and the economic benefits of our struggle did not rebuild communities. Now, if they had went in there and fought, I can't get mad if someone over here fight for their community to bring resources and someone do that and you sit there. No, you're supposed to be in there fighting just as hard. Mm. I blame all of those leaders who was able to make it because of that movement who did not build those communities. Saying, well, no, it's not Rahm's fault. Rahm is the mayor. You're the alderman. You got a responsibility. You're a state rep. You got a responsibility. You're a congressman. You got a responsibility because we elected you. It's almost like blacks still have taxation without representation. You know, so those people squandered our movement. And that's how I feel. That's the thing that went through me this last few days was that, dog, these people squandered our movement. And when you see the children, and I know how we got beaten, and you see what went on, and then they've taken Dr. King and turned him into an ML or Martin. They got children talking about ML or Martin, not Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a spiritual man, a man who believed in God. Don't go out and do destruction in his name because Dr. King did not try to overthrow or destroy America. He tried to make America live up to his creed. To the Constitution and to make us, to make sure that we had equality and we desegregated. So that's, I have a whole different take because I knew Dr. King. He was like a father of mine as I traveled. And I was trained and taught by the best with Dr. King and Bevel and Andy, C.T. Vivian, Diane, Miss Carr, Rosa Parks, and all of them. So when I see these people fall, that's why I don't join in all these marches because it's a game. So one thing we did do, we would plan. We had structure. We would plan what we were going to do. We went out and we did. We went out, we prayed, we went out and we did. We prayed while we was out. We came back, we analyzed, and we did some more. They just say, meet us on so-and-so. Let's go do this and go back. And there's nothing that happened. So that's how I feel like people squandered. They have really just messed up what we gave them. And then you got other people from outside our community. They're utilizing our struggle. They're using some of our people, and they're doing it in the name of Dr. King, even with violence.
Well, we'll have to continue the conversation. I feel like there's a lot more we can do. Another hour, two hours. The big table is going to have a co-host.
Thank you.
Dorothy Tillman, the former 3rd Ward Alderman and civil rights leader, in studio tonight, talking about the anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And, of course, the subsequent days here in Chicago.
And know that Dr. King believed in America. He always said, redeem the soul of America. We are Americans. The descendants of enslaved blacks in America are America. I don't care if you came from somewhere else. I don't care if you're black, brown, white, or whatever. You're different from the descendants of enslaved blacks in America. We have a stake in America. Other people have currency. They have country. America is our home. We have currency, and this is our country. So we want to still work to redeem the soul of America.
Ms. Tillman, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, Sarah Gruenberg, the famed chef, award-winning chef at Monteverde, a great restaurant in the West Loop, and now the host, Dish-alicious. WTTW starts tomorrow night. Of course, Sarah Gruenberg of Top Chef fame coming back to television. Excited she is here tonight live in studio. She'll be coming up right after the news. Stay with us. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, jam-packed, Paul Rust will join us. He is the co-creator with Judd Apatow of the show Love on Netflix. Just wrapped up their third and final season. Paul came on. He plays the role of Gus as well as being the co-creator and producer on the show. He came on when the show debuted. And it was great to talk to this, you know, this comedian in L.A. who got this opportunity. Now, 3 years later, three seasons, he's back on the show to talk about how it's evolved and how his career has changed. So Paul Russell joined us. Also, Greg Dooley from Afghan Wigs will join us. They are coming to Chicago with Built to Spill. They're playing at the Riv coming up later in the month. Greg Dooley, a long time, I would say, he's calling Pete a spokesperson for alt-rock, and he's had quite a career, ups and downs, and we'll talk about the Afghan Wigs coming back together and Greg Dooley and the band coming to Chicago later this month. Well, speaking of this month, a new food show comes to Chicago television. It's called Dish-alicious, and it'll air tomorrow at 8:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11. The show has a familiar format, watching chefs cook their favorite recipes, but what makes Dish-alicious different and great is that it takes one genre of cuisine, say Italian, Mexican, Korean, and pairs together some of the best chefs in Chicago to work collaboratively on one meal. For instance, the first episode is just called Italian, and it features Chef Tony Montuano from Spiaggia doing the main course, Chef Giuseppe Tenturi from GT Fish doing the appetizer, and pastry chef Leah Omolinski from Nico Osteria doing the dessert, which is amazing. It's all brought together by host and award-winning chef Sarah Gruenberg. Gruenberg is chef owner at Monteverde in the West Loop and a recent James Beard Award winner. The show Dish-alicious is produced by David Manilow, the man who brought us Check Please, Early Reviews, Say It's a Hit, and Sarah Gruenberg makes her triumphant return to the Download. Chef Gruenberg, thanks for being here.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me.
tremendous congratulations. I mean, it is. The Tribune piece Steve Johnson did today was great. People are excited about this
really
concept.
Exciting.
What does it mean for you to be back on TV? I didn't even mention in the lead that you are a Top Chef celebrity star, but this is a return to television. How's it feel to be back in front of the camera?
It's so fun. It's really a blast. I never knew that I had a career in TV, but I really like it. So it's different than competing and, you know, fighting to win and turning into that like warrior chef person. It's a blast. I really, really enjoy it.
Well, you get a chance to work with a lot of your respected colleagues, people you've worked with for years, but how much of hosting a show have you been able to pull from your experiences from Top Chef both times, you know, the season you were there, but also going back and doing the gauntlet? Like how much do you say, oh, I now know how a TV show is produced?
I still don't think I know how a TV show is produced. It's one of those things that, it all comes together, and David Manilow is great. He is like very like, I don't want it to feel like anything. Like, I don't want you to rehearse. There's no, you know, plans. You just get over there and cook. And I'm like, we're chefs. We have to plan. Like,
right.
We need like some structure here. So that's what's really fun about it is that we're all just hanging out. It's like a dinner party. And you're all invited kind of idea. So
now this show's in front of a live audience,
yes,
which is the fun part about it. It really does mimic in a way the cooking shows that you might see in Food Network or other places, that traditional format. But it does vary in the way that each chef is in charge of one part of the meal, and we're talking about extremely talented and respected chefs.
Yes, the lineup is incredible. Italian that airs tomorrow is Tony Montuano and Giuseppe and Lee, and they're all great chefs. And you know, it's fun because I still get to learn from them. Like, the way that they all cook is so different, even though it's one style of cuisine. And that's what I think I love about cooking, is that it's so personal. And to have each chef on, talk about their story, and then I get to add my color and my story to it is, I think, kind of magical.
For you as the host, a lot of times when you're the host, you're moving the show along. You have a different role than being the person who has to show us how to mix this recipe or make whatever's in. But is that hard for you as a chef to not be like, get out of the way, I'll show you how to do these cutlets?
Not so much that, but to not want to get my hands in there is hard. You know, being a chef, we're hands-on. We want to get in there and cook. And I learned a lot. I mean, even doing the Mexican episode, Chef Diana made these enchiladas I've never seen before ever, and I wanted to try to make them. So it's, being a host is fun because I get to take a step as kind of like the student and the person that, you know, keeps it going. Mm-hmm. So I definitely try to learn a little bit during each episode, but it's fun to keep it going. I really have to find, I have to keep the energy up and really be the glue between all of these chefs.
Is there similarities to being in the kitchen? I mean, I think about it because you are a celebrity chef. You know, obviously have to plan and put everything together at Monteverde, but there's similarities to being in front of a camera, in front of a live audience, and working in that environment and working in a kitchen?
I guess, you know, I've never thought about it like that, but when you have an open kitchen like at Monteverde, I guess we are cooking in front of people as an audience.
Come on.
However,
you never think about that?
No,
everyone's like just accidentally looking back around their shoulder, like, oh, what's over there? And they're looking at
no,
you.
No, because chefs go through these blinders. Like, we like put these glasses on when you're in the restaurant and you're in chef mode, and you better watch out because we're like, man, you know, we're like in, you know, the guy that, you know, in the orchestra, the maestro that's over there, like, you know, directing everybody. So the audience really plays an integral role because it brings the energy, and all the chefs, it makes it more fun because then we're also entertaining, and it allows chefs to show that side versus that cutthroat, I can make a better souffle than you, or whatever, like, which really at the end of the day isn't important.
That's a really interesting point I hadn't thought about, is that with the competitive food shows, and they are extremely popular, and whether it be Top Chef or any of the shows that are on Food Network, you get this concept that that is what cooking is about. This
and
race
now for
to
kids,
it.
Too.
Right.
How many kids compete? Like, these poor children out there. I mean, I can't
but
even
that's
imagine.
Not really what being a chef is about, right? No. I mean, there's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of chemistry and teamwork, and it's not necessarily about competition.
I would agree. And, you know, so much of that's what makes those competition shows hard, like Top Chef. When you go on your own, you don't have that team behind you to help you do many things. So you can be the best chef in your restaurant, but necessarily not be the best chef on a show like that.
That's a great point. They should do a new show where, I mean, they probably already have these shows. I'm not the one who's coming up with new ideas, but
yeah.
Where you bring your team too.
I mean, that restaurant would be amazing.
Yeah.
That would be great.
I don't want to put new
kind of
ideas.
Like Iron Chef would brought like two of their sous chefs, which was really great. But I think what Iron Chef did, which is fun, but it's like making five dishes out of the same ingredient. So, you know, there's always some twist or you know, kind of thing. Us were just like, let's cook Italian tonight. Come on over. Let's have some fun.
The show is Dish-alicious. It's on WTTW Channel 11. Starts tomorrow night at 8:30, right after Check Please, on Channel 11. All right. Chef Sarah Gruenberg, who is also the award-winning chef at Monteverde, which is, what, coming up almost on 3 years?
Yes.
It's amazing. We'll talk about that. But,
insane.
Chef Gruenberg is the host of Dish-alicious, of course, former Top Chef contestant and award-winning chef, James Beard award-winning chef. We'll talk more about the new show and her career coming up here, so stay with us. Chef Sarah Gruenberg in studio. She is the new host of Dish-alicious, which is the cooking show that takes esteemed, respected chefs here in the Chicago area and puts them on stage in front of a live audience to cook one dinner together. It's great. It comes out tomorrow night, right after Check Please on Channel 11. Of course, Chef Gruenberg at Monteverde, a James Beard Award-winning chef. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you excited to make the rounds, James Beard come back here in the next month as being the champion?
Well, it's a lot less stress now. It's a lot less. I mean, it was amazing. I think what's fun and what's really surprising now is that I have a lot of friends that are nominated that I'm really excited about on a local level and a national level. So yeah, it's exciting, and I'm excited to go party and have some fun.
You've had such a dual career in the way that you have had the success, the celebrity success of Top Chef, and you're one of the more recognizable celebrities from that show from your time, both in your season, but also coming back for
Thank
the celebrity.
You.
But also you have the respect of winning the James Beard Award and having the respect of working at Spiaggia and being someone who is known well in the industry. Those things aren't always part and parcel. How do you see your career and what you're known for at this stage in 2018?
Well, I think the best thing is that it's all building blocks, right? So to get to the stage, I had to take a journey, and I think there's still a journey after this, of course, but it's really cool that I'm able to own a business and have a responsibility to the team members that work there. Like, that is the big difference from going from executive chef of a restaurant to it being your own baby. And I love that. You know, I wouldn't say cooking was always, I always loved doing it, but it wasn't always easy. Being a line cook and getting in there and doing it is very challenging. And I'm so glad I didn't, but I almost went to go be a flight attendant. I don't know why. I like to travel. I was like, oh, I'll go do that. And I didn't, but I always tell myself I couldn't see myself doing anything else. Like, if I close my eyes today, I have to cook. And the year that I had off in between Spiaggia and opening Monteverde, it was a hard year. Mm. You know, cooking is something for chefs. It's a way of us to share with people our emotions. And it's something, a gift, I think, that we share with people. And it's one of the few art forms that you actually like partake in and have a emotional, kind of experience for.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's a challenging field in the way that all the jobs that you just mentioned, whether it be line cook or working in the restaurant, being even executive chef, and the hours are grueling. The stress is high. As you mentioned, having a packed restaurant is, there's a lot of energy, but there's a lot that you have to do.
It's very delicate. It's
very
a delicate balance.
There's, I mean, the hours, especially as an owner, I can only assume are all 24/7. How do you do this job, Monteverde, and then also host a talk show or a cooking show that's going to air on Friday nights?
I don't know. Well, I think because it's fun, and it's a great way for me to get out of the restaurant and have some, excitement again in another way. I think as chefs, we're always trying to push ourselves to be better. I don't know how I had time, except I can say that we filmed in January, and that's a great time to film in Chicago because it's snowing and the restaurants aren't as busy. But I really have to say to my partners and my team at the restaurant, you know, we have three amazing sous chefs that work there, and they work really hard and make the food great. And that's really how, like, if I didn't have a team that could support me, then I probably wouldn't be able to do this.
You've had a tremendous career in being able to have people that you work for that have been open to new opportunities. You know, working for Chef Montuano and getting an opportunity to spread your wings and do your own thing. You have always talked about, in the other interview as well that we did, you talked about just, you know, the process that to get to where you're at. Going into television and doing this talk show, or it's not talk show, cooking show,
yes,
demo kind of cooking show. Do you have to approach it the same way? Do you think, I mean, are you leaning on other people to be like, how can I be a better host? How do I really start to develop my personality when it comes to being a host on television?
You know, I think that there's a good team at WTW, a great culinary producer that took care of all of the recipes for the chefs, because that was really important to me, that the chefs feel set up. When they get there, they're not struggling to figure out where all their stuff is.
Right.
So at Monteverde, we actually have a team of three cooks that came every episode, and and manage the kitchen for the guest chefs. So I think, you know, kind of still had my hands in it a little bit. That helped me be, I think, a great host, because then I learned the recipes. Yeah. I was invested in the recipes because I was helping our team at the restaurant. You know, some of the recipes, we've never heard of the ingredients. And so it was a fun experience in the beginning, you know, before we went on to film. And I guess that's what I think helped me the most to be a host, was that I was familiar with the recipes in some way. I enjoyed them and I love the chefs, and I was really good friends with the chefs. And so I guess to be a host, I just went on there and did me. As bad as that sounds, I don't know if that sounds good or bad, but I just really did. I went on and was like, you know, it's either going to be great or it's not. And that's what David said. He was like, you know, we're filming three of these things, and just go up there and have energy and be fun. And that's
well, David Manilow, who is the man behind Check Please, and he has never hired a chef. I mean, he's had people in the food industry and maybe media personalities or people who, but he has never had a chef be his host. But there's something great about it, and this format, this cooking demo format, where, you know, people are doing the live cooking in front of an audience. It's not new to people. People are familiar to.
Yes.
But there's a high end part of it, which we see on and some of the shows that are award winning and shows that you're like, wow, that's amazing what these chefs have done. And then there's a low end to it, that format where you see the local newsman like, we've got Chef Sarah Gruenberg here. She's gonna make some Brussels sprouts, you know. And you're like, so there's a lot of ways that can go. But there's something really great about what is done here with this show, because of the respect and the talent of both what you do, but also the people that are featured.
Yes, and that all of us kind of end up cooking together at some point during the show. You know, we're not like just there chained to our stations, like, you stay over there. Like, it's a really collaborative thing. It's fun. It's about kind of what would happen if you threw three chefs in a kitchen environment. I did... for James Beard Foundation, I went to their chef boot camp, which was a 2-day seminar. And we were on a farm and we participated in all kinds of things farm. And the last night, all of us, all the chefs, and it's like 20 chefs, okay? And we all made a meal.
Wow.
And we were divided up into groups. So we all were responsible for a course. And that was fun. That was like, it was like kids in a candy store. And that's what this is chefs getting together and cooking together, but not necessarily for them. Like, I think that's what's really fun about the show, is that the chefs are cooking to share their story. And a lot of the recipes are dishes that are important to them, not necessarily their restaurant.
For you, you Spiaggia and, of course, Monteverde, you have really doubled down on Italian. That's something that you have brought in, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, as you just mentioned, I mean, there's an episode that's Mexican. There's an episode that's Korean.
Yes.
When you're in those situations and you're seeing other respected chefs cook different genres of food, does it inspire you?
Absolutely. And Top Chef inspired me. That's why I think in my finale, I started to have a lot of Asian influence in my meal, because you don't have recipes. You cook based, inspired by what people are cooking next to you. And that's the same thing for the Korean and Mexican episodes. It was fun to learn. I think Mexican food, I'm from Texas, so Tex-Mex, I don't hate on it because I love it so much. But Rick Bayless is like, no, Tex-Mex. So it was cool to see a lot of the stories of the real authentic Mexican cuisine. And then Korean food, I mean, to have Bill Kim and Beverly Kim and David Park there and talk about their families and how the history of the family. And one thing I learned the most out of the Korean episode was how in the Korean cooking, they talk about the hand, how the hand is important. And I was like, oh, that seems weird. Like, what is that? And what they mean is that the kimchi changes by who makes it because of the hand of the person. And that for me was an aha moment, because it's very true. Recipes are changed by the hand that makes them. It's just simply a guideline, but that's what really makes cooking interesting.
Yeah. All right. So what's next? I mean, question. What's next? I mean, you tape these, they're going to be out, but is the goal to continue to queue up more episodes? Is the goal to get out of TV altogether and start your eventual dynasty and empire here in Chicago restaurants?
Empire.
What's next?
Oh. Well, you know, the goal is to definitely do more dishalicious's. Oh, that was a good one. Dishalicious's. Because it's fun and it's great for the city. And I think we could take it many ways of just neighborhoods in the city, or, you know, cooking styles or a specific dish like pizza or something like that. And then for Monteverde, I don't know. We're starting to talk about something new, right. But I don't know. It's in the baby stages.
All right. You got to promise to come back when it gets a toddler phase.
How okay, about that? Maybe, toddler phase for
maybe
sure.
Maybe young teen.
Okay.
Tween. Sarah Gruenberg, the chef at Monteverde and also the host of Dishalicious, which will air tomorrow night after Check Please, 8:30 on WTTW Channel 11. It's the Italian episode, which features Chef Tony Montuano, Chef Giuseppe Tenturi, and pastry chef Leah Omolinski. Thank you so much for coming on the show, talking about it. Great to see you, and good luck with the show.
So fun. Thanks.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest came on the show when his show debuted on Netflix. That was 2+ years ago, and the show Love just released its third and final season.
My dad's going to seem maybe angry or mean, but he's just quiet and reserved. And my mom, she can get a little loud sometimes, especially after a few drinks. But, you know, fun loud. I don't know. They're great. I love them. Seriously, they're the best.
That is the nicest talking I've ever heard. Relax, it's gonna be fine.
I know. I want you to like them.
Okay.
I mean, they are a bit conservative, so I don't want to be like, tone it down, Mickey. But
no, I get it. I will not bring up abortion until after dinner.
Okay.
The romantic comedy follows Gus, Mickey, Birdie, Chris, and others, all in Los Angeles, trying to make it, not just in the business, but in their relationships. The co-creator, who also plays Gus, is comedian Paul Rust. Rust plays opposite love interest Mickey, played by Gillian Jacobs, and the show's co-created by Judd Apatow and Leslie Arfin. Rust is a comedian, writer, and improviser who may be ending his show Love, but it will be remembered as one of the best the streaming channel has produced to date. Paul Rust, welcome back to The Download.
Aw, thank you for having me back. I'm glad I didn't, you know, mess it up so badly last time that I was an unwelcomed guest for all eternity. That's good.
No, well, congratulations on the successful 3 seasons. You and your co-creators got together with Netflix and determined that this would be the final season. Why end it?
Yeah, you know, I think we felt like we wanted to, you know, it had been a conversation always sort of like amongst the creators, Judd and my wife, Leslie Arfin, along with Netflix. You know, we were always having a conversation of, hey, when do we feel like this would be the best time to wrap things up? And, you know, as we were talking about it, we felt like this was an appropriate time. That's inappropriate time. A-N, appropriate time, not inappropriate. You know, because I think we felt like we wanted to do a show where you stayed invested the entire time and that there wasn't that sort of plateauing of enthusiasm that a viewer might have as a show lumbers on. So, and the reaction to the show so far has been that it feels like we went out strong, which I guess in the old showbiz expression of leave them wanting more, you know, I feel like we accomplished that.
What I love about the show from, you know, watching it when we had you on before and watching season 2 and season 3 is the evolution of the characters. And as you as a writer and as this being your show, as being a co-creator, how much of that is in your creator's eye from the beginning, knowing how this is going to play out? And how much of it, as a writer, is it about improvising and changing arcs and characters' destinations as it moves forward?
Yeah, you know, Judd has said that this was the first thing he ever worked on where he didn't have the ending set out in his mind. I think creatively, the way he would work is sort of he knows what the ending is, and then it's about working towards that. And with this, I think we all felt it was going to be best if we kept our sort of options open. And that was true with the entire series, but also with the end of every season. The way we would write it is we'd always kind of keep those last 2 or 3 episodes, you know, maybe having a vague idea, but leaving it open so that if we discovered something along the way while we were shooting the season, we would have the luxury of writing it. And I think, you know, that choice overall probably had to do with the fact that it is, you know, something that's more based in character than plot. And if a character starts, you know, you do a scene and you kind of like, oh, it was interesting that character A did X. Mm-hmm. Now we can kind of explore that. We're not locked into this. Well, we know they have to be in Greece by episode 6, you know, right. So they got to go to the travel agency and set up a trip. You know, like, right. it allowed us to keep things organic, which I do think in the end ended up helping with the characterization.
What I love about as the show evolved over the 3 seasons is the creative risks that you would take with the storylines, because it is a romantic comedy. But there was a lot that went into the emotion of the characters and the real. I mean, there was more drama at times than there was comedy and people trying to figure out their relationships or figuring out where they're going or who they were, et cetera. Does that come with being comfortable, understanding your characters, but also being comfortable in your role on the show and understanding what love is to you as the creator?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it primarily comes out of, you know, wanting to make sure that when people are watching the show, they feel like with each episode, the character is being deepened in some way. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're growing. In fact, a lot of times the fun would sort of be, you know, an expression we used a lot in the writer's room was sort of like one step forward, two steps back, where we'd let a character kind of grow and then maybe do something that, like, they sort of backslid back into their older selves. And so, you know, the fun of the show is figuring out ways to deepen the characters episode by episode without, like, having them so fully developed and grown that you're like, well, why am I watching these people who are now fully self-actualized?
Right.
So, yeah, and then, you know, to speak to what you were saying about the, you know, the comfortability or whatever, I think just having notions about myself or relationships I've been in or friends or people I've known, you kind of have that in your backpack the whole time of just like, all right, if somebody was in this scenario, what was it like for me when I was in a long distance relationship, or what was it like for my friend or that person I knew? And you sort of draw from that as a way to get inspiration.
Well, that speaks to my next question about you creatively, both as a writer and an actor in this show. Over the 3 seasons of Love, how have you evolved? How have you seen your performance and your leadership, but also your creativity evolve, not just as Gus, but as Paul, you know, being the guy who put this together?
You know, it's interesting because since the show began and ended, my wife, Leslie Arfin, who I said we co-created the show together with Judd, in that time, we married, and we have a beautiful baby girl now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I certainly, you know, grew up faster than Gus did on the show. But, you know, the interesting thing that kind of happens is as I'm growing or not growing in my own personal life, it gives you the knowledge, or I wouldn't say wisdom because I don't think I'm very wise, but it gives you some sort of like ability to kind of look back and go, okay, when did I make a mistake? When did I not? When was I good? When was I whatever, quote unquote, bad? And it's this kind of strange little dance where you can't have that insight unless you've grown up. But if you, you know, a lot of times I have to accept, sort of put my vanity or my desire to be liked by an audience to the side and go, you know, the only way this character is going to continue to be interesting is if I continue to, and we all, you know, the writers and everybody continue to make him complicated or sort of like frustrating. And I have to fight the knee-jerk response of wanting to be beloved by everybody in order to keep the show interesting. Because I think if I did a show that was like a 12 episode long commercial for why I think you should like me and think I'm a nice guy, it wouldn't be a very interesting show.
Paul Russ is my guest. He plays Gus, and he's the co-creator of the show Love, which just wrapped up its third season. It's on Netflix. You can find them all there. You know, what's interesting when you talk about, I was just thinking about the way that Netflix is still a pretty young platform in the way that there haven't been too many 30-plus shows that have been produced. But the idea of a finale, you know, a show wrapping up, is still kind of new to the platform. There's not a lot of shows that have had that wrap up, or maybe they just kind of went away. They didn't have a choice to do that. And yet, at the same time, they're all delivered at, you know, with this binge idea that you get every episode at the same. So there is no watch party. There's no get together with the cast on a Friday to watch the final episode of Love. How do you approach that? How do you approach the idea that this all gets put out on the one day and it's the beginning and the end all in one day?
It's closer to the experience of, because I've acted before and written before for episodic television, like the classic model of it's coming out week to week, and that's really exciting because you get to kind of wait every 7 days for something to be introduced, and you get to read or hear the public's response and viewers' responses. With Netflix, it is more similar to the experience of a movie coming out, where it sort of has a weekend where it comes out, and then you have maybe like another weekend or two as people talk about it and spread it around. And so it is you spend a year plus writing and shooting and editing it. And then it is, it actually really brings me back to my days of like high school theater, where you'd work on a play and then on Sunday the play's done and you kind of like, I wouldn't say get depressed, but you certainly feel this like loss of like, oh, and now it's done. And I am so grateful that we were able to have the finality of a series, because it does, just in terms of personal closure stuff, it really does help to feel like, okay, that had definite closure and it wasn't just sort of this thing that like vaporized into thin air or something.
What is this show, as we wrap up, what's this show prepared you for? Three seasons of Love, this was your baby, this is, you know, obviously your other baby and that you co-created with your wife and Judd Apatow, but what has this done to prepare you for your next chapter in your career?
That's funny, I was talking about that with Judd, you know, Judd on the phone recently, and Judd said very lovely things. He was like, well, you know, this was, it wasn't, you know, necessarily training ground, because if it was really training ground, it would have been like school, where it's not like a large segment of the population is watching the student film I made in college. It's nice to have that in anonymity. But I do feel like as I move forward, I learned so much just in terms of writing and acting and what works and what doesn't, but also really just like what it takes to, and this sounds super dorky, but how to be a leader, you know, and right, how to like keep enthusiasm up for a group of people and keep people excited. And primarily, like, how do you, you know, everybody I know has worked on shows before where you contribute, but you want to know that your contributions are meaningful and that you're being seen and heard. And I think that was the main thing I took away from this, is just like, you get the best out of people if you make them know that they're seen and heard, but also that that they're valuable to the process and people are open to ideas and stuff. So, and honestly, that's not just like so other people feel good. Selfishly, it makes a show better. There's a funny thing that sometimes when people are acting on a set, on other shows or whatever, they kind of, there's fear on set and sort of a terror. And I know sometimes people think that's beneficial. Like, if people are scared, they work their hardest because they want to do their best. But in my experience, when somebody's calm and comfortable and feels relaxed, that's when they do their best work. Mm-hmm. So I never really understood this sort of like weird pressure that put on sets, because it's like, guys, you know, when this feels like a clubhouse is when we get the best work done. So, you know, different strokes for different folks, but that's definitely my takeaway from working on this.
Paul Rust is the man who plays Gus. He's also the co-creator, along with Judd Apatow and his wife Leslie Arfin, of the show Love. The final season, the third season, is out on Netflix now. Paul, we look forward to what you got next for us, and congratulations on a great run with the show Love.
Oh, thanks a lot, Justin. It was a great chat with you, as always.
You and I, we might be strangers. However close we get sometimes, it's like we never met. But you and I think we can take it. All the good with the bad make something that no one else has but you and I.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, coming up on April 12th, The Riv will be the place to be for one of Chicago's most anticipated live shows this spring, featuring Built to Spill and the Afghan Whigs.
Criminal, I bet you bet. See the knife in the water, send you back to bed.
Afghan Whigs reunited a few years back, and last year they put out a new album called In Spades. The indie rock band has been a long fan favorite, with hits like Debonair and Gentlemen playing heavy rotation on MTV back in the day. They were a Cincinnati band, Cincinnati area, signed to Sub Pop Records. They were 90s rock and roll through and through, with major label stints on Elektra and Columbia Records. The band broke up back in the early 2000s, and frontman Greg Dooley went on to other projects, including solo work. But they're back together, back on Sub Pop with In Spades, and now on a whirlwind tour with Built to Spill. Joining me tonight on the line, the great Greg Dooley from the Afghan Whigs. Greg, a pleasure to talk with you tonight on the download. We appreciate you taking some time out.
Nice to be here, Justin. How are you?
I'm good. You know, Chicago has to, let's just start right there. I mean, I know from seeing you on stage, Chicago has played a huge role in the Afghan Whigs touring life and coming through here and playing Metro and the Riv and other places like that. When you think of Chicago and coming here in April, what comes to mind?
Well, I lived in Chicago for a while, so I have, you know, deep roots in the city and have been friends with Joe Shanahan for over 30 years. And I come there every year, regardless of whether I'm touring or not. I stop by and watch Cubs baseball, whatever, usually every summer at some point on my way back to visit my family in Cincinnati.
There's so much history when it comes to Metro and bands like the Afghan Whigs and just that movement that came out of here, whether it be the Smashing Pumpkins or Urge Overkill and the bands. But to think of the Afghan Whigs and to be someone who was here in Chicago in the 90s and think about the lines around the corner, do you look back at that time, even with living here, with fondness to those memories of playing at places like Metro and other places in that genre and that time period?
I rarely look back. You know what I mean? As Satchel Paige said, something might be gaining on you. So I'm quite content to be in the here and now and facing forward. I have had some great times, but like others have said, if you remember it, you weren't really there.
Yeah, right. That's a good point. All right, the Afghan Whigs. What I love about getting back together with the band and reading about your story, hearing about your story and how you guys were on tour and then were able to just parlay that tour right into new music. When you start writing, because you are constantly writing as a musician, as a songwriter, are you writing for one specific project in mind? Do you think about your solo project or the other bands? You think of the Afghan Whigs when you're humming a song, starting the process of writing music?
Since 2012, when we did the reunion tour and then subsequently made our first new record, Due to the Beast, a couple years later, and then in spades, like, when I've been writing songs now, they're all Afghan Whig songs. That is my going concern at the moment. I'll be doing a solo project probably in the next year and a half, but and I'll worry about that then, but as for right now, I keep myself pretty unconfused by just writing for one project at a time.
What comes first for you? Does the music come first? Do the lyrics come first? What in your process is what you start with?
The music always comes first. You get a riff, you get a melody, you scat some nonsense on top of that. You make that nonsense make sense later on. Same thing I've been doing since I was 14 years old, you know? So it's not rocket science. I don't even consider myself a songwriter. I'm a song maker. That's what I do.
The songs throughout the Afghan Whigs history have painted a picture. And are the songs about you or are they about a character? Because there's a lot that...
I mean, sometimes they're about me. No one is so interesting that all songs could be about them, you know? So I take little bits from here and there, certainly some personal experience, personal observation, overhearing a conversation, a record I like, a book I like, a movie I like, you know, there's so many ways to get inspired. If there was just one way, I probably wouldn't be interested in doing this. So many ways to come up with the treasure, you know.
When I think of the Afghan Whigs and the fact that you took more than a decade off, when you put the albums side by side, think about the music that you've produced with this band, is there a progression to it? Are they thematic in the way that they're almost chapters in your life? Or does that change when you take a various amount of time off between records or like we said, a decade plus?
Right. But see, I never stopped. I just changed the name of the group I was in. So, you know, I was the Afghan Whigs. I was the Twilight Singers. I was the Gutter Twins. Right. I was Greg Dooley. Then I was the Afghan Whigs again. It's just like, the train just keeps rolling. It doesn't matter what it's called. It's rock and roll, and here it comes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it.
Without looking back, because we got that at the beginning of the interview, do you see it as a progression? Do you see, can you be able to mark the evolution of Greg Dooley?
Absolutely. From day one to today, like, I actually know what I'm doing now. So, you know, it takes a while. So there you go.
What about now? What about Greg Dooley now? How do you see it? How do you see what you're doing now and what it means to you and your career moving forward?
I mean, the last record we made was a full band record, and those, I hadn't really done one of those in like 20 years. So when you get the group in the room and make the songs together, that's really special. And that happened this time for the first time since Black Love. So that's what makes this record different. It has a cohesion based on the personalities that made the record. We were all together the whole time. That's what sets this record apart from, say, Due to the Beasts or mm-hmm. 1965 or any of the records before it.
A lot of the ability to go on tour, obviously do this monster tour with Built to Spill, but fan loyalty is a big part of the Afghan Whigs. I can't tell you how many people go crazy when tickets for your shows go on sale. My Facebook feed gets flooded. You know, I'm 43 years old, and there are a lot of bands that don't have that longevity, don't have the ability to get my peers out of their homes at this point, right? What's the secret to continuing that fan loyalty, to have people get so excited about an Afghan Whig show?
You know what? I wish I knew. I'll tell you what, like, me and any group I've been with have done our best to make the best record we can, give you the best performance that we can. There becomes like a mutual trust between you and the audience. And that's sort of like, I mean, I feel tremendously blessed and grateful to have the wonderful audience that I've been able to perform for 30 years. I have no idea exactly how it happened, but it was, you know, it was organic and very natural, and it's excellent. You know, it's my favorite group of people to play for.
You know, we'll have a lot of bands come through and talk about getting on the road and touring, and obviously with, you know, what you're doing with Built to Spill. But they talk as well about how that relationship with their audience is now changing in the way that now you can go straight to crowdsourcing, you can go right to crowdfunding, you can go to find different ways to be a musician, a professional musician, and have a more direct relationship with your audience. Do you see yourself doing more of that kind of thing and following in the footsteps of some of your peers based on the fact that you have lived this life in rock and roll?
Constant evolution. I'll do anything that I'm personally comfortable with, you know. Meet and greets and VIP package experiences, those are all great if everybody's down. You know, as long as everybody feels good about what they're doing, I'm cool. And I love meeting the people that we play for. 9 times out of 10, it's somebody I'd have lunch with. I feel really lucky in that regard.
For this show to be on the road with Built to Spill, to have it be one of the big concerts that are coming through, and think about all the different markets that you're going to be hitting, but also the city of Chicago. What's it mean to have this kind of bill to come through with this kind of power bill that everybody's looking forward to?
I'm excited. You know what? I mean, first of all, I'm excited to do some shows with Built to Spill. I've been a fan forever, and but have never met Doug. So I'll be meeting Doug for the first time. It'll be my first time, you know, meeting that. And I hope we end up jamming together. I really do. He's a badass musician, super talented, amazing guitar player. Can't wait to meet him.
Greg Dooley of the Afghan Whigs. The album is In Spades, and the tour comes to Chicago on April 12th at the Riv. Greg, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Hey, Justin, you're welcome, man. Have a great day.
Hear me now, and don't forget, I'm not the man my actions would suggest. A little boy, I'm tied to you, I fell apart, that's what I always do. This ain't about regrets, my conscience can't be found.
right, Patty Vasquez coming up next here on 720 WGN. We won't be on tomorrow. We're back next week, I think Tuesday, because the White Sox, Friday, Monday, Blackhawks as well, the last weekend here. And we got great shows lined up next week, but just follow the – we'll be around. That's the way I kind of look at it now. It's like, we'll be around.
Justin, I feel like you're questioning your existence right now. What's going on? You're seeming very
I have to. I'm just in
nihilistic.
My head.
Am I wrong?
I'm trying to figure out in my head when I'm going to be on the radio.
Well, it's a chaotic season for you. It's your team on our station.
Oh, man.
And it snowed at their home opener.
Did you like it?
I left during the snow. I thought I was with Brian Noonan and Ernie and Ben, and I thought, well, this seems like a good time to go. And now I'm worried. I'm not sure how Sox fans are about superstitions and like traditions or whatever. If I was there when they scored four runs, is it now my fault that they lost because I left?
No, it's Joaquin Soria's fault for giving up four runs in the ninth inning.
That happens.
Yeah.
To the best
it does. It does happen.
Look at Justin.
For some reason, it happens in Soria's career more than others, but
okay.
That's all right.
Oh, well.
Don't get me started.
It was great, though. Okay, so great. I was at Cork and Carry after everybody left. I got there just after John Williams finished his broadcast, and I walked in, and I'm thankful for my Sox fans and friends because I've never done that. I've never walked into a Sox bar on a home opener. I mean, it was loud.
Sure, yeah.
It was chaotic. Yeah. The energy was amazing, but it really kind of felt like I was a soldier in the Civil War who had crossed territory lines. And I was wearing black and white, but it was my Blackhawks colors. It would be wrong of me. Don't you think it'd be wrong of me to show up in like White Sox colors or wearing a White Sox hat?
Yeah, maybe. If you're not into the team,
it's not authentic.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
I love baseball.
Yeah.
But I did run into friends of mine in the park, like from all over the city, who couldn't believe I was there. Like, that's how intensely of a, obviously public Cubs fan that I am.
That's awesome. I used to go to Jimbo's. I was asking Pete, it's Jimbo's, right? The old bar that was just south of the park or north of the park. And that place is long gone now.
That,
so it kind of dates me a little bit because I feel like the
you
last
have your
time
spot,
I was,
though. Yeah.
But the last time I was really interested in going to an opening day party, I know the Cubs do it at Yahtzees and stuff like that. But I moved on from that for a while
that
back.
That Cork and Carry party was outrageous. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. But I walked, it was wall-to-wall Sox fan, and I just felt out of place. I've never seen
that.
It's
a good place to be wall-to-wall Sox fans, 33rd in Princeton.
Oh, man. By the way, is it me or do Sox fans own more pickup trucks than any other, any other Chicago team fan?
Maybe.
I have a photo of just, they're
blocks
all either white or black. And they have Sox plates, and I was impressed. I mean, they show up in ways that Cubby fans do not.
They do not.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a
break.
And then Patty Vasquez coming up. Stay with us.